I'm Chris Voss, and welcome to another segment of Out of the Box. This time around, I'm joined by Grammy-nominated virtuoso mandolinist Avi Avital, whose newest album, The Art of the Mandolin, is out now. Avi Avital, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, and always with pleasure.
All right, so I have a lot of questions about this album. It is very, very, very cool. But before we get to anything on the album, would you mind just elaborating a little bit about what the mandolin is?
Well, the mandolin, as we recognize it today, is an instrument, normally we would say four double strings, so eight strings, with the origins of Italy, and more specifically Napoli, in the 18th century. This is the short answer. The mandolin has a fascinating history, and it's always developed according to some kind of shifts in socioeconomic movements or demographic changes and so on. But it started as a salon instrument. When you think of this, its measurement, its acoustic qualities, it's not an instrument you would take outside to play in the piazza or in the big village feast, right? Because you wouldn't be heard. It's more of a salon instrument, really delicate, sweet. So it was adopted really by these noble people. It was the bon ton thing to play. It was the instrument that the young maiden from a rich family would play, a little bit like the harp or the spinet, the little harpsichord, a sign of good education. Then in the 19th century, it became more of a popular instrument. Through the beginning of the 20th century, we find a lot of mandolin orchestras, or some of them were called mandolin clubs. And after work, you gather with friends from work or from other social circles, and you play together music. And that was the way to enjoy music back in the beginning of the 20th century. And the mandolin, for many reasons, was a great instrument for that. It's inexpensive. The entry point is quite low. So like to be able to play something on a mandolin is pretty quick. That's the ukulele of today. I mean, you see ukulele in every household nowadays. And I think that was the mandolin back in the day.
Well, I love how you put that. But, you know, you say that the barrier to entry on the mandolin is quite low, and perhaps that's true, but I imagine it does present some challenges for people like me and like you who have bigger hands. It must be kind of hard on such a small instrument to play it incredibly precisely.
That is true. The thing with the mandolin is very cruel in terms of precision, my goodness, because when you think of it, first of all, you have a metal string, which is quite tense. You have the plastic, a piece of plastic, which is the plectrum. So already the sound is made from a hard piece of plastic on a hard piece of metal. So the attacker is there. You cannot fake it. I mean, you know when the sound starts. And as for the left hand, you have the frets. So again, the frets are pieces of metal that define where the sound starts, right? So string instruments like the violin and the viola, the cello, they don't have frets. That means that sound will come. Well, there is an intonation problem there, but you can fix it in the millisecond you realize. With the mandolin, if you miss by a millimeter or less than that, the sound would not come out. So it is it's kind of a high precision instrument, technically wise speaking, and my big hands are really a problem, you know?
I love this about your story. When you were first learning to play the mandolin, you didn't learn from a mandolin teacher, but from a violinist.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's crazy to think about it, but every kind of step in my education was unorthodox in terms of what a mandolin player would have normally have as an education. So the story is that my teacher, he was this Russian violinist, really, and he came in the 70s to Israel, was way before I was born. I was one of his last students. But when he came, he was searching for a job as a violin professor, and he couldn't find one. I mean, he came to my hometown, Be'er Sheva. They already had a violin professor. And so they really didn't have a job to give him, but they told him that they had mandolins in the cellar. They don't know what to do with them. And if he wanted, he could start the mandolin class. And he said, okay, the mandolin and the violin are tuned the same. I just have to figure out the right hand, the other things, but I'll do that. And he taught himself the mandolin, wrongly, by the way. He see videos of him. It's completely off how he plays and how he taught us. So it's very funny when you look at the cover of my album. I chose this picture on purpose because you clearly see that I hold the pick in a very weird way. I mean, no one holds the pick like that. But that's how
still?
I learned.
Still today?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was wondering this from reading your liner notes, whether or not you've changed your playing once you started to learn from mandolin players.
I did not. I acquired things because afterwards, in my 20s, I went to Italy. I studied with a real mandolin professor. I practiced the traditional way of playing, the technique, the way you hold the mandolin, the way you hold the pick. But it was only to discover that it was actually good the wrong way. Actually, some have some really advantages over the pick. And I think it's because that, well, for him, he needed to translate the bow concept into a plectrum concept. So I think this is why he was intuitively picking up the pick, the plectrum, the piece of plastic, the way he did. So he would have the range of changing those angles over the string, which you don't have in the traditional way that you hold a pick. Usually it's just parallel to the string. The pick is parallel to the string. That's how people play it. So really this quote-unquote wrong way to hold a pick was, and still for me, I'm not here advocating for a new system, but for me it was really like full of advantages. So from that Italian teacher, I took some concepts, I took some wisdom, because there is a wisdom of a tradition so long, and I installed it, I kind of embedded it into how I was used to play already.
Well, I think this dovetails nicely into the art part of your album, The Art of the Mandolin. What did you set out to achieve with this album, and how is it different from your other mandolin albums?
Great. So I don't have other mandolin albums, and this is the big the big change. And it's all connected. You know, for me, this album is really big personally because, you know, as you can assume, the way I approach to the mandolin was not of a mandolin player. So I never saw myself as a mandolin player before I am a musician. And still, until today, I see myself first of as a musician and then as a mandolin player. I learned first how to play a melody before I had to learn how to play the mandolin per se. So that's kind of conducted my artistic life. All my albums were, until now, are pieces by Bach or by all the other composers that did not write for the mandolin, or not necessarily for the mandolin, just because it's beautiful music and I happen to play the mandolin. It's a technical fact.
So when you say you don't have other mandolin albums, you're not saying that you don't have other albums,
yeah.
But that all your other albums feature primarily arrangements.
Mainly, absolutely, mainly. The mandolin was not the focus of my playing. And in fact, the mandolin has lack of repertoire. I mean, the big name composers do not write for the mandolin, most of them. But in this album, I wanted really to, I had two questions that I had to myself. You know, with every album, you try to put a canvas, to limit yourself. So you will have a listening experience of like 60 minutes that has a theme, that has the same, it's under some kind of a topic, right? So the first limitation that I put for myself is the question, what are the best pieces written originally for the mandolin, in my opinion? And this is the set list. This is the playlist that I would say, like, these are my favorite mandolin pieces in the classical, of course, the classical music tradition. And the second thing that I kind of thought of it afterwards is really how did these composers saw the mandolin, really? Because if I say most of the composers didn't bother to write for the mandolin, because the mandolin was not a serious main stage instrument, it was more amateur, it symbolized different things in different places and different times. It was aristocrat instrument, and it was more kind of a popular instrument in America, it's bluegrass. So of course the composers that wrote for the mandolin, when they did write for the mandolin, it is for a reason. It is because they use the mandolin to symbolize, as a metaphor, to reference to something. And this is why I call it art of the mandolin. So for Vivaldi, it's this cute instrument. It's not so serious. And it comes across from the two concerti that he had. Beethoven had a different motivation to write for the mandolin. He was in love with the mandolin, with a young lady who played the mandolin. It's kind of wrote for her this little love song, really, with a beautiful dedication, by the way. Hentze saw it differently, Solima saw it differently, the contemporary composers, each of them had a different view, a different thing, that imagination that the mandolin evoked in their process.
Well, and it's also, I feel like, a very outside in instead of inside out concept, right? These aren't mandolin player composers. These are composers coming from the outside who maybe didn't play the instrument, writing for it.
That's exactly. When I started to gather the music for this album, I still didn't think about this, the second thing that I was talking about, but I was just looking for mandolin pieces. And of course, there is a big repertoire of what I call mandolin composers. You see it also with the guitar. There are mandolin players themselves. They wrote only for the mandolin, which are figures that are very important for the development of the mandolin, of course. But if you're not playing the mandolin, probably you never heard of them. And that's when I realized that I want the outsiders. I want people that didn't look of the mandolin like a mandolin player. Imagine he has a violin or a cello or just other instrument. But how do other people look at the mandolin? It also helped me to look at the mandolin through the perspective of different artists, different composers in different times, in different centuries.
Well, so you mentioned Vivaldi, and you also mentioned Beethoven, but I want to actually skip those two composers and talk about Scarlatti. You have a piece on the album by Scarlatti, mostly known for keyboard music, Scarlatti, but you and your teacher came to the conclusion that, after some research, that this particular piece might have been a mandolin piece?
Yes. Yeah, so Domenico Scarlatti's work he never writes the name of the instruments, but you clearly have two lines, right hand and left hand. Now, some of these sonatas, five in particular, are very different. It's obviously not for keyboard, these specific sonatas. When you play it on a mandolin, you think that Domenico Scarlatti is Neapolitan. And there are some idioms, there are some things that are very typical for mandolin. And if you played enough mandolin music, you can recognize these are idioms of the instrument, like some arpeggios. The second movement is all arpeggios. Not natural for an instrument like the violin. And to conclude that, there was a copy of a manuscript, which is old, but is not signed by Scarlatti, that indicated the same, it had the same music of this sonata, and was the indication was like for mandolin and basso continuo. So the theory is pretty solid for me, but for me, I'm not a musicologist, so I don't have the proof, but for me, it was just enough to play it, and it's like, it's familiar on my hands, it is for mandolin.
Would you mind if we jump in and talk about some of the 20th and 21st century pieces on this album, particularly David Bruce, because I think this is a very interesting piece. It's got a great collection of instruments on it: mandolin, harp, guitar, theorbo, and harpsichord, all plucked instruments, and all of which frequently used in the 17th and 18th centuries, but which are used in this case in a 20th century work. It's kind of unusual.
Yes. So with David Bruce, the task was very specific. I was putting a concert on a couple of years ago for Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg, and it was all around plucked strings. So we wanted to take the five plucked strings of the classical Western tradition, the mandolin, the guitar, the harp, the harpsichord, and the theorbo. And for the grand finale of that concert, I asked David Bruce to compose. I commissioned for him to compose a new piece that will evolve all the five strings, plucked strings together. I think it's the first time. It's the only piece that I know that is written for all of them. So it was quite a task. It was quite interesting. How do you compose for all these plucky strings together? Most of the times I cannot recognize like who's playing what. Is this the guitar? Is this the harp? You know, they all blend together in a wonderful, it's unbelievably colorful. David did a great job. This is one of my favorite pieces, I have to say. I've been commissioning a lot in the last years. I mean, this is part of a mission that I feel is very important. It's very important for me because I realized, as we said before, not a lot of composers in the history of classical music wrote for the mandolin, and it kind of stopped the evolution of the instrument. And I wish to kind of change that. I really want to change it and to have, in 100 years' time, looking back, a great repertoire for the mandolin. So I'm working on that, commission a lot of pieces every year. And every time I speak with a composer, the first question is, what does the mandolin mean to you? What does it symbolize? What do you think? The first associations. And it's unbelievable how each composer has a completely different answer. And then you hear it in the piece. So it's fascinating for me. I discover my instrument over and over again through these pieces and through these approaches.
On that, I want to talk about the Paul Ben-Haim piece as well, because it's a piece I imagine is close to your heart with its mixing of classical and Israeli traditions.
This is also very unusual for Paul Ben-Haim. So for those who don't know, Paul Ben-Haim in Israel is considered a forefather of classic art music, classical music. Yeah, he was born in Germany, actually, and was studying in the Munich Conservatory and started a pretty good career as a composer till 1933. He fled and came to Israel. He lost his job in Munich and, you know, came to Israel. And then he had, you know, an artistic identity crisis. He says, like, I cannot compose like Schoenberg. I cannot compose the way I composed in Germany anymore. This is a different cultural situation, and the art needs to be reflected. He wasn't the only composer that was resonating with this style, creating the Israeli so-called classical music. And also everywhere, it was a common practice. Bartok did it with Hungarian music. Defaya did it with Spanish music. Villa-Lobos with Brazilian. Piazzolla with Argentinian. It was quite common to start to kind of reflect your culture into the art music, into the concert music. So Ben-Haim did it with Israel, only that Israel is, what is Israel? There is a lot of cultures put up together. So he explored a lot of, music from different traditions, from different Jewish traditions that were found in Israel, Jews from Yemen, from the Maghreb, from East Europe, of course, the local Arab music, the Bedouin music. Or really, he went on research a little bit like Bartok and kind of embedded this in his music. Now, for the mandolin, he never wrote. I mean, actually, this piece was found in the archives in Israel by a good friend of mine, Yuval Avital, who's a guitarist. And he was dusting one of the shelves and he sees this draft of a piece. It was kind of a finished draft, but never published piece by Paul Ben-Haim. Years after Paul Ben-Haim passed away, for mandolin, guitar, and harpsichord. And it was so shocking because no one wrote for this combination before. And it was very surprising to find even an unpublished piece by such a famous composer. Why did he write for this combination? The mandolin sometimes sounds like this ancient Middle Eastern instruments, like the saz, the tar, the Persian sar. The harpsichord sounds like a kanun. The guitar sounds sometimes like oud. So he really imitated local Middle Eastern Arab instruments into this piece. So we reconstructed it, we produced parts that are readable. His handwriting was tremendous, so it took us a lot of time to kind of decode that. And we played it for the first time in 2001. And that kind of gave me the cue to play a lot of Israeli contemporary music and a lot of contemporary music in general, and to commission a lot. I think that was very important for me in this case.
Well, Avi Avital, it has been absolutely wonderful to talk to you. I have one closing question I want to ask you, and perhaps it's a similar question to one that you ask composers when writing for the mandolin. But what do you hope people get from this album?
Well, first of all, I hope they will enjoy beautiful music. Most of it is not very familiar. There is a big discovery factor when listening to this album, I believe. And that's what I wanted, first of all, and to present and to maybe give a key to the listener to experience the mandolin through the lenses of the composers, but also to have their own experience about the mandolin.
Avi Avital is a Grammy-nominated mandolinist, and his newest album, The Art of the Mandolin, is out now. You can find out more at our website, classicalwcrb.org/out-of-the-box. Avi Avital, thank you so much for taking a moment to talk to me.
With pleasure. Thank you.
I wanted to ask, that has nothing to do with this album, but it was like, how do you get the mandolin to be heard over an orchestra when you're playing?
Oh, that's a valid question. This is not a normal mandolin. It's like the mandolin I play is by an Israeli, Arik Kerman, his name. And he had also, he's like this crazy genius maker who had the same kind of, at the same time, the same vision like me and my colleagues, I mean, this whole school of Simcha Natanzon, which is to put the mandolin in the main stage. And so he developed a mandolin. He said, like, okay, the mandolin, the traditional mandolin is small, it's beautiful, it's sweet. How do we make it a stage instrument? So he started to modify the traditional way of doing it. And you know, there is like two soundboards, for example. He did a lot of modification acoustically. And this instrument, like I played in the Berlin Philharmonie with a big orchestra, no amplification. And it was, the sound was absolutely heard in every seat in the hall, I was told. And he also just simply by using a violin making techniques into mandolin, because mandolins traditionally are mass manufactured. So he was, for example, buying his woods from the best dealer in Germany. So the best violin makers would buy the wood from them. And for years, he taught, of course, after he's 84 now, so he's doing this for 30 years or more. For years, he would lie to this vendor to the dealer that he's making violas, just from the fear that if he would tell him that he makes mandolins, they would send him the cheap wood, you know, the not the best. So he was like selling himself as this genius viola maker just to get the better wood to build actually mandolins. And then he confessed to him, and they're good friends, of course.